In this Peter Hill Explains, I go into depth about just an internet page up intended to help students, and it does help students understand the thorny concept of time dilation. I'll just get into it. At the moment I'm doing a cardiac rehab walk in the Australian bush. It's nice and cool. It's going to be hotter in the day. I'm able to do it, so you'll hear a few bush sounds as I walk. Let's talk about, firstly, what is time dilation? So, as something speeds up relative to you, its time slows down. It's an additional effect to the effect that you observe due to the Doppler effect of it moving towards and away from you, into the past and back from the past into your present. These two clocks speed up by that primary effect. This is another effect in which the actual clocks themselves, the frame, the time within the frame itself slows down. Now, firstly, let's get into the idea of what a frame is. Now, a frame is a coordinate system, but for practically imagining, a frame exists. Everyone has a frame, and it's really in the centre of their head pointing forward. So you're always in your frame, and you can imagine other people having their frames. Now, the idea of time dilation is that as you see another frame, view another frame, we'll call it the viewed frame, the T viewed, or T subscript V, the clocks appearing in that frame slow down. And the occupant of that frame, T naught, or T occupant, is your own frame. So you're in T naught of your frame, and someone else in their frame has got their T naught, their clock. Obviously appears to go the same speed. This is a hard thing to actually get your mind around as to why, and the why actually goes back into the curvature, or the lack of curvature, the actual property of space-time that's described by four coordinates, X, Y, Z, and a complex T-coordinate. And that complex T-coordinate is a fairly... So a complex number times the number of seconds gives you your four space-time vector coordinate in space-time. So those points exist at a particular point in time and space, and they can be relative to anybody. But if you've got a relative frame, any relative frame which is moving towards or away from you, the clocks slow down. And the maths description... people are really hunting for a physical model, and so what they do is that they create a light clock, because then that corresponds to the Einstein's postulates, which revolve around light. So Einstein, to start off with, said that as a principle of faith, as a postulate, one is that for all frames... So everyone, no matter in the universe, we're going to come up with a laws of physics which is true for everyone, so we don't have to rewrite the laws of physics for every individual. So everyone in all frames of references have the same laws of physics, so you can swap, you can develop a explanation and check that it works in the additional frame looking back. So it's an agreed, it's almost a diplomatic view. The second aspect is that the... speed of light is constant for all frames, and there's a whole lot of implications for that. And for Einstein, he had a unit of light, C, but he, in physics, when we're dealing with special relativity, so it doesn't actually count, and you won't be doing this at school, you make C equals 1. That simplifies a whole lot of things, and in terms of our actual development of our science, we've actually effectively done that by making the definition of a meter, or length, of how far light travels in 1 second. So we've virtually done that already. But so with the two postulates, let's start out looking at what happens with a light clock in a train going from your left to the right, and this light clock has a tick. Effectively, when you move, it fires from a laser at one point, hits a mirror and bounces back. So equivalent to a light pendulum going tick tock. That's a method of measuring time, and it involves the speed of light. So it's got a whole lot of advantages in that. Theoretically, you can observe it from a distance. You can observe a pendulum going across. It doesn't have any light; has no mass, so it's not going to feel any. Well, this is a bit more complicated, but it's not going to feel any changes due to shaking or momentum or anything like that. Now, what happens is that inside the train, the clock goes tick tock. But if you're standing outside the train, that light appears to go in a zigzag as the train's moving from left to right, as it goes from left from the near to the far side of the carriage and back again. The light inscribes a zigzag path. Now, saying that we, in this case, agree that the lengths, the transverse lengths, that's the length. Stay the same as you're going across. This is a hard thing to establish, but we just shove that to you. And that light travels at the same speed. Therefore, the viewer, T-viewer, will see the light inscribe a longer path. Therefore, the light will have a... therefore, the ticking of the clock or the time, everything that happens in that cabin has slowed down, and that's your basic proof. And there's a little bit of trigonometry there, and so this is in this I think it's school kids page on special relativity, and it's definitely the easiest and most direct way of understanding that indeed in traveling frames the time slows down. Just to recap, people have observed this in many experiments where you have to make a series of experimental leaps, but in our real world there's probably three popularizations of it, or one not so popularization, but much more, the third one's a much more indisputable version of time dilation, or the dilation effect. One is the when cosmic rays hit the surface of the atmosphere, they quickly hit an atom and smash it and create a whole zoo of particles, including the next generation of electrons. They convert electrons into muons. So these are heavy electrons. They don't last for very long. And they should only travel a few meters, even at their incredibly high speed. But indeed they last all the way down to Earth, and the reason is because their internal clock has been slowed down, or we view it as slowed down. And so you get into that by the lifetime of muons. So we are being showered with radiation from cosmic rays. Our atmosphere is not thick enough to save us because of this time dilation effect. The second effect is when someone said, well, look, I'm going to put a atomic clock in a aircraft and fly it around the Earth and do that in a reasonable time, so it's got a relative velocity, and using that measure within experimental error time dilation. Now, this is a 1950s experiment. Of course, now we have satellites with atomic clocks just circling the Earth, 36 of them, or hundreds of them now, with atomic clocks and atomic clocks everywhere. And it's now a routine effect, but because it's more a theatrical effect, sort of like when people talk about Shakespeare, they talk about when Shakespeare himself did a play, that there's a lot more interest in that. So we have it all around us. The third effect of time dilation, or length contraction, is in fact electromagnetism. And again, essentially, if you have two parallel currents converting to the two frames, the observer frame and the actual frame with the average velocity of the electron, the conversion of that leads to an apparent length contraction from one wire view to the other. This length contraction looks like a charge, building up a charge, and explains why if you have two parallel wires, the wires fly apart. Now, that is not an actual fact. Although it's full of maths and it's easy to calculate, that's not a popular viewpoint because our school's blocked itself off on several points going forward. Now, one of the things I'm going to do is convert this to a riddle to help people work their way through it, referring to this diagram. So the diagram's on the Associated blog page, and I'm going under academic, I suppose, privilege as a teaching point. I'm just reproducing this in order to teach. Getting back to it, the first riddle is, or thing you have to spot, is that the unit time, the light travels from the near side of the carriage to the far side of the carriage, but the train itself travels a greater distance than that in that unit time. Now, there is a mistake associated with that depiction. I'm going to allow you to pause now, discuss, and see if you can think of what the problem might be with the carriage moving a greater distance in the unit of time than the light does, moving from left to right. So I'm going to stop now and allow you to switch off and come back when you have decided the answer yourself. Okay, we're back again. So the overall problem is that the length of any vector drawn in your diagram, the length of that vector actually represents a velocity vector. It's a distance vector, but a distance vector in a fixed unit of time is effectively a velocity vector. So you can imagine plotting your courses of planes on a map between two points of time, and one plane moves a greater distance. That's moving greater speed or velocity. And so the problem with this is that if you have a light as your moving thing, you can't actually have your train moving faster than the speed of light. But it's very obvious what happens there. And it's, obvious to what's happening. I've got these people bushwalking up here. G'day. Hi. Okay. So that's our first problem in the depiction here. Let's talk about another problem. In the top diagram, the laser is pointing at the mirror, which is quite obvious. You're in a train and you've got the mirror directly across the left hand as you're travelling the left hand side of the carriage. You're at the right hand side, it's got to bounce back and forward, so the laser is pointing perpendicular. If you go down to the second diagram, you'll see this fairly common mistake. Shouldn't give it away, I suppose it is a mistake. The laser is actually turned off to hit the mirror in its actual, as you'd aim it if you're sitting in the carriage. It's actually aimed forward at so many degrees such that the light will travel in a direction in order to hit the mirror, the new location of the mirror. And there are several problems with that, in that the laws of physics and the observations have to be the same from each the observer of the occupant. The viewer, I call it the viewer because it corresponds with the V, and occupant, which corresponds with naught. It's a bit of a dyslexic rip-off to make sure you don't make mistakes. So I'm going to allow you to switch off your podcast, pause it, and the problem is, What is the problem of drawing two diagrams from the occupant's diagram and the viewer's diagram in which a key piece of furniture is put at an angle with respect to? So go to the webpage and look at it. I'm going to pause now and let you switch off and think about that. Well, we're back again. There's an obvious problem, similar in the diagram. Just looking at it, you're not allowed to draw a velocity greater than the speed of light. That's one. But now, you're not allowed to say that one person's framework would measure a different angle for the positioning of the laser. Yet, it seems very intuitive that the laser actually has to actually bend forward to send the light forward. So what actually does happen in real life, if you've got a light source and you move it, what will happen is it will, as you put a velocity onto your light source, the light source will change the angle at which it projects the light. Now, this is a bad thing when you're trying to explain to kids, especially if they've got a series of bad explanations already. But this phenomena of light bending in or forward in the direction of its velocity is right back to another principle of Einstein, a more basic principle of Einstein, which is to do with causality, what causes events. You can't violate a law. That's a sort of a more fundamental law that he has, in terms of everyone has to agree on a cause, so it has to be a causality. And it's to do, also do with simultaneity. And so what actually happens is that in the occupant's frame, the wavefront coming out of the laser is all parallel. But in the viewer's frame, the parts of the wave farthest away emit first, and this swings the wavefront round. So from the viewer, sees the laser light come out, but it then swings at an angle because there's a as far as the viewer is concerned, the laser has a phase, has developed a phase, a phase delay. That's one line of explanation you can go across. There are other effects which you have to take into account for the viewer. If you take in all the phase delays and things like that, the viewer sees the actual train itself as rotated as it comes past and flies across. So one of the things is that an object flying at this relative speed is actually rotated. So there are two avenues to really look down and think about this problem, that you're looking at simultaneity and almost as an extension of that simultaneity time. So you're looking at the rotation of objects as they come across. And so here you've got sort of buried in the explanation, deeper things which, you know, you sort of buy a quick explanation, but then you suffer from a deeper problem in that you suddenly have objects travelling faster than the speed of light, or objects in two different frames rotating, and indeed they do rotate, but not out of sync to the rest of the frame. And now we've got the heat of the day has increased, and we've got the first wave of cicadas, and they will really go up to really high volume. I'll have to walk out of this part of the national park if I'm to get any further. But we're nearly finished now. Look, there's going through the maths, it's a little bit hard to follow how they derive the Einstein's time dilation, the dilation factor gamma, which is 1 on the square root of 1 minus So 1 of the square root of 1 minus v squared, v on c all squared, or v squared on c squared. That's dilation factor. And I'm going to have a little quick talk to so you can walk around with your head with a good set of rule of thumbs of dilation factors and be able to basically waltz through any special relativity question. So there is a third, what I call style error. I suppose I would call it almost a dangerous error. And that's something which I can't make a quiz for you. It's the subscript, or the actual use of subscripts. Now, so just very quickly, they put a T naught where traditionally we would put a T viewer. We would say the T as viewed, the time of a frame as viewed, which is TV or T velocity. And so I think it's actually, that's my own way of getting through the student confusion by replacing velocity with viewed. Then you have to actually think about velocity and get across. But in this equation, they've put the subscript naught. Now, the issue here is that we have students, I suppose, stage one is a poor classroom explanation. Stage two is you go to the internet on a well-presented, clarified explanation, which has these little sleeper errors in it. So sleeper errors in that you have things going faster than the speed of light, things inside frames distorting, but not the whole thing distorting. And then the subscript, the honour, the I suppose fussiness about subscripts is not there, of how you use symbols. And indeed, you find that education is way behind NIST, or the agreed scientific conventions, and so they don't sort of use subscripts as a way, a shorthand of clarifying a concept in this circumstances. And it follows the way that we use subscripts follows C programming, a whole scientific movement called object oriented, or which in this case concept oriented. You've got the same concept and you keep on adding detail to it with your subscripts and various subscripts. So you can have T viewer 36 seconds, so the time observed by the viewer, 36 seconds of, you know, into the fray, I don't know, and another subscript by method. You can just keep on adding more and more adjectives, but not in a long sentence, but it actually descends down your subscript trail. So, yeah, you've got this overall problem of education in general, in that what happens is that if you have the meticulous thinker, the person who really needs everything, last thing he explains before they move forward, well, they're at a disadvantage because the actual explanation universe is very light and superficial, and there's a tendency to test right away before people can get into it. So that's the end of this podcast as I come back home, and the cicadas have come down, of Peter Hill Explains. And again, this is not supposed to be an earth-shattering podcast. It's a podcast in support of a blog page, which is in support, not a critique, but an analysis of an education page and some of the mistakes in it. Let's finish off. One of the way people judge, is that a good explanation? They see if everyone writes the correct answer, which may be misconceived in the first place, and people award themselves, pat themselves on the back, saying, "This is a great explanation." And then, if you do come up with a correct explanation or ask things, there's, I suppose, a defensiveness, and people, I suppose, the best form of defence is offence, and so they quickly shut things down so you don't get to discuss it. However, on the end of it, by discussing the errors in an interesting way, you can actually get a greater, deeper understanding. So it's perhaps not for the students, but for the teachers to actually go in and look at this and try and understand the depth of the explanation and try and build up for themselves an explanation of how we're explaining the things and why. So that's all from Peter Hill Explains for this episode. In the meantime, keep on doing science.